Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro. Show. They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck all the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fully promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the counselor, the elder, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys, that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Welcome to Possibility Project. This is our 35th episode, which is just wild. Today we're talking about appropriation and reparations. How can we take restorative action? And so Possibility Project is a growing community of disruptive change makers, reclaiming our power through meaningful sparks, connections, and actions. I'm so excited that you're here and joining us today. If you have missed any of the previous episodes, you can see any of them on possibilityproject.org. There's 34 other amazing episodes that have occurred, so you can check those out. And all of the episodes are also posted by our friend Mickey Desai on his podcast, Nonprofit Snapcast, and he also has them on another new podcast called Inclusion Catalyst. And if you look at that, that link to the Google Doc, you'll see links to Mickey's work. And so I will keep moving. So I am Heather Hiscox. I'm the co-creator of Possibility Project and now the host. And this was started in, I'll describe myself and I'll talk about how it all came to be. But for anyone that might be disabled visually, I'm a white woman with light skin, freckles, red hair, blue eyes, and I'm wearing a bright blue top and a blue room with art behind me. And I'm coming to you from the land that was kept and held sacred by the Tonawatam and Pascuayaki people. I honor these ancestral keepers of the land where I am now living, and I honor their descendants who continue to breathe sacred life into this earth. The territory acknowledgments we do mention, and you'll see a link in that Google Doc. It's just one small part about disrupting, dismantling colonial structures. So if you want to know more about it, please go to that resource, nativeland.ca. And I also want to acknowledge that many of our guests, not on this episode entirely, but many of our guests do present a U.S.-based perspective, but we are open to perspectives from all places and spaces. I just want to recognize that. So I'm Heather Hiscock, CEO and founder of a company called Pause for Change, and I work with nonprofits, local governments, and philanthropy to learn new problem-solving skills. So this was co-created in March of 2020 just to provide a space where we could have conversations about these more disruptive topics, and it's just gone on and on from there because the community has grown, and so many people are deriving benefit from these chats, so I really hope you will stay connected and come back for more in the future. These are the goals of the Possibility Project: to bring together this community, stimulate this new thinking and a thirst for this deep change that we're longing for and we want to reimagine, work collaboratively to see what's possible, and then start with ourselves. I think Catherine, you were saying on our speaker chat that I stuck with me the quote that the revolution starts from within. It starts with all of us. And so I love that thinking, and so we really hold that in this space. And this is an entirely volunteer project, so if you can support in any way to make it possible, that would be fantastic. So you can go to opencollective.com/possibilityproject. They're our fiscal sponsor. And in the Google Doc, you also see that we have a LinkedIn community that right now has 810 other change makers. So please join and click that link as well.
They just walked out the door.
And so this is how our time is going to flow together. We do things a little bit differently. So if you've never attended, I like to tell you about the agenda. So we're going to do intros. I'm almost done. You'll meet our amazing guests. And then the first part, we always ask two questions on every episode. What's dysfunctional about this topic that you want to disappear? So that's how do we get here and what is messed up? What's emerging that gives you hope is our next question. Then there will be opportunity for Q&A. So all along, as questions pop up for you, please put them in the chat. And I will start to go through those and be prepared to ask our speakers your questions. And then we'll go to breakout rooms. After our speakers do intros, you'll meet another beautiful person here today. And then once our speakers are done with their two segments and we do our Q&A, you'll be sent back to a group of two others, so it'll be three total, just to talk about and debrief what you've heard so far and have a space for deeper connection. And then we'll come back for some takeaways, and I'll talk about the next episode on September the 15th. So the why behind this, and Julie spoke to this in her comment, like, we hear about reparations, we believe in the necessity and power of it, but what does it look like in real life? What are ways that we can make change? What do organizations do? What's behind all of it? And I'm excited about the next episode as well, which is really about just redistribution of wealth. So I feel like this episode and the next episode really connect together to talk about money and movement. Money is medicine. How can we really think about wealth and redistribution in different ways? So we're starting with appropriation and reparations in this chat. So our speakers are so awesome. I have known of them and known them for a couple of years, and I've just been trying to find the perfect opportunity to bring them together and on what topic. So I'm so excited to introduce Catherine Evans, President of Rooted Strategy, Tommy Johnson, Chief Education Officer of Made with Black Culture, and Alan Quabena Frimpong, co-creator and managing partner of Adaptive Collective. So I'm so excited that they're here. And we do introductions a little bit differently. And you've read their impressive bios in the reminder emails that you received. So you see how phenomenal they and their work are. But we like to have our speakers tell a little story, just something that's interesting, fun, intriguing about them, just so they become instantly human. You've seen their bios, but they're just phenomenal people. So I'm wondering, Catherine, will you kick us off and let us know how you're doing today and what you want to share with us?
Absolutely. Thanks, Heather. Thanks, everyone. Glad to be here with you today. I'm Catherine Evans. I am in Kansas City, which is what we call the unceded territory of the Kaw, Kickapoo, and Osage people. This is a home that I have chosen for myself and my family, and I'm grateful to be joining you from here and connecting with people, it looks like, all over the country. So I am going to share what is right in front of me. So the space that I'm in right now is kind of my sacred space. It's my place where I work. I meditate. I do coaching work and have family time in this room. So everything that is set in this space is very intentional. And the three things that are sitting right in front of me, I want to share with you. So the first one is, this is a little robot that my 5.5-year-old daughter made out of some 3D puzzle pieces. It showed up on my desk one day, and I wondered where it came from, and she told me she made it, and I just kept it there, and it kind of just reminds me of her throughout the day. I like the way it looks. And then I have this little framed picture of a little stick person doing a warrior pose. It says power, and it's framed with a black frame. And I received this as a token from a mentor that I had years ago in my early career as a community organizer. And I just have always kept it front and center to remind me of my own power, the source of power that I have that brings me into this work and allows me to be resilient and sustained in everything that I do. And then the final item I'll share with you is my little kitchen timer, which I keep on my desk because I just like to hold myself accountable to not letting work linger on too long. And so I sometimes will set a timer on when I'm getting ready to do a task or a project. I'll set a timer for myself, and when the time is up, I am done. So it's my little way of keeping myself accountable to how precious and valuable my time is so that I don't squander it. So that's it.
I love that. Thank you for sharing all of those. Yeah, it's always fascinating. If people could see what's in, like, behind the screen, that would be very interesting. One day we should all just post that on LinkedIn and be like, and here's the mess behind like the clear background. Tommy, would you please share a story with us?
Yes. Peace and blessings, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for your energy, your attention, your presence. I'm honored to be here. Big love to you. Had this for just consistency. 35 episodes is a big deal. And as an organizer myself, I know the energy that goes into being consistent. But the beautiful thing about consistency is it leads to everything good. And you see the manifestation of that with all the people who are tuning in today. A story about myself. I'm outside of my, you know, my highest passion of organizing Black America for economic progress. I'm also a mountaineer, and I live here in Los Angeles. And part of the reason I'm originally from Baltimore. I moved to LA about 7 years ago from New York, and my pure inspiration for moving here was I just wanted better weather, fresh food, and access to more nature. And that's exactly what I got when I came here. But I always tell my father, thank you for giving me access to nature. You know, nature is everything. It heals us. There's nothing to project on in nature. So you get a chance to be, and you get a chance to feel all of the energy, be with yourself, and just really observe the natural flow of things. And the story for me that always connects me to nature is when I was in sixth grade in Baltimore, my parents blessed me with a four-wheeler, an ATV. And when I tell you, it was hands down one of the most prolific gifts I could have ever received. It changed my life drastically because we lived next to a forest area. So there were trails and wild animals and creeks, and being able to get on there and ride through these trails and see like herds of deer going through these creeks and running over fish and frogs, and just parking with my friends to sit down and eat in the middle of like the nowhere. It really, really was the what I call a trampoline point for my love for nature, for my understanding of nature, for the peace that I felt just being there, because we would literally be, we would leave the house at maybe 11, and I would come back at like 6 at night, 7, right before the sun went down. So it would be a full day of just riding around on the trails and discovering new places miles and miles away. But it was in those moments of like pausing and having a conversation with friends and seeing the way animals work and move that I really began to understand not only my own nature, but just the power of how all of our solutions and answers to how we can operate harmoniously, actually the examples are in nature. So I wanted to share that story because at the end of the day, for me, you know, we are looking to create a more harmonious world, harmonious environment, harmonious home, harmonious relationships. And my ultimate, like, grounding source is always nature, whether that means going outside and taking off my shoes, just standing in the grass, centering myself that way, or going on a hike or going backpacking camp. But it all goes back to 6th grade, 11 years old, being gifted with an ATV, and that being my access point to discover all types of nature. So I look at myself as an urban naturalist. I love all things metropolitan, but I really, really, outside of that, like, my ideal thing would probably be to live on a farm somewhere with, like, 15 dogs and enjoy the land. So that's my story.
Oh, I love it. I'm right there with you. I am right there with you. Yes, nature is the go-to place for restoration. Absolutely. Alan, let's meet you now.
Hey, folks. How's everybody doing? I'm just glad to be on the call with everybody. Thank you, Heather. And I'm excited to just, you know, rock and roll with Catherine and Tommy, you know, and I've known Tommy for, you know, a good minute. It feels like we've been brothers for a long time. And Catherine, I'm just excited for us to rock and roll now and then until post this call. But Alan Quabena from Pong here. Quabena means born on a Tuesday. It is the day of the river, of the Akan people, of the Ashanti folks back in Ghana and West Africa. So I always do a shout out to my Ghanaians if there are any on the call, whether directly or if you're a friend of the family, we all welcome you because we're a people of gratitude. Of course, Afia, there we go. There's always one. as I put in the chat, I am in Inglewood, California. Not too far actually from Tommy, on Tongva land. As we think about the topic that we're discussing today, the other piece about me is that I'm a big lover of art and music, and I also co-founded a cooperative called Zeal, which is a creative agency and social impact collaborative. We operate as a cooperative. And we create spaces for Black artists to thrive. And yesterday I was with my good friend Tia Oso, who's also one of my business partners, cooperative members in Zeal. And one of the songs that we talk about in the work that we always go back to when we start talking about reparations is this song by the Staples Singers. I don't know if folks are familiar with them, but if you know Mavis Staples, you must. You have to. Because if you don't, you must get acquainted. I'm going to go ahead and put a link in the chat to one of their songs. But it's When Will We Be Paid? And this is one of Tia's favorite songs. And so I'm sharing it because whenever Tia and I are in conversations about this topic around reparations, the song comes up and she'll start singing it. And it really makes me think of that time when the Staples Singers were creating this song, and this was actually in the 70s, you know, so I wasn't born in the 70s, so I'm a child of the 80s, but I'm definitely a lover of the 70s in terms of music and culture. I'm also a big house head, so if we know anything about house music, you know, the disco of the 70s heavily informed house music. And this tune was actually written by Randall Stewart, and Mavis, you know, sings the hell out of the song. And the moment that they performed the song that I was able to watch on YouTube was when they performed this song in Ghana, you know. And at that time in the early 70s when this song was being created, you know, think about it. Ghana is, you know, Ghana's not even 100 years old as a country. And it is a major site of also the transatlantic slave trade, as we talk about reparations. And so the song to me just also just embellishes a lot of what we have gone through. And it's not just about a conversation about money in terms of what is paid, but also it's what do we owe each other as human beings? And what's the emotionality behind how we relate to one another from a space of redemption, grace, and healing? And so whenever we at our meetings for Zeal are thinking about the next, you know, art or cultural project that we're working on with Black creatives, the song pretty much is a grounding force. And so it reminds me of how much music can be a grounding force, art can be a grounding force in propelling social action forward. So that's the story I'll share for now, but also I'll be heading back to Ghana in about 2 weeks, you know, with my goddaughter and now cousin-in-law so that they can reunite with their dad. And I'm going to be reuniting with my dad too because he's back there in Ghana also. So I'm happy to join y'all and just looking forward to the conversations and seeing what we learn together on and what we're able to grow together with once we leave the call.
Thank you, Alan. Oh, I'm so excited for you to go home and be with your family. Beautiful. Well, now this is the part where we go to the questions, right? And we always ask those same two questions. So I'm going to ask Catherine to kick us off. What's dysfunctional around this topic that we need to have disappear? What would you say to that?
Thanks for letting me kick things off. So I want to just frame this by saying that I come from the perspective of a coach and a consultant and sort of part of the living system of philanthropy, I should say institutional philanthropy, nonprofits, and grassroots networks. So that's where my contribution to social change is as a coach and a consultant. And I want to focus today for this topic primarily on institutional philanthropy, or what we know as foundations, because this is a place, this is a subsector of our ecosystem that I see as having a lot of dysfunction that it doesn't often see in itself. And I think the primary dysfunction here is that institutional philanthropy is rooted in oppressive systems of capitalism. And, you know, when you think about how these foundations were started and why they were started, the primary purpose was to hoard or preserve wealth, right? And so, and then to be able to perpetually draw on that wealth to serve the interests of the original funder, right? Or the family or whoever it is that designated that foundation to exist. And so to me, the roots are bad. Like I always say in my practice at Root of Strategy, my sort of like motto is, if you want to grow, you have to start at the roots. And I think that within institutional philanthropy, the roots are rotten and we've got to dig them up and start anew. The way that this dysfunction plays out is through these established patterns of extractive relationships with the community and specifically with Black and Brown communities in the United States. And it's really very much in line when you think about the sort of cultural history and the cultural heritage of the United States. There is a very strong element of extraction in that history and in that heritage. And so understanding that the same, you know, organized money that started institutional philanthropy in the U.S. is also the same organized money that benefited from exploitative labor of Black and Brown bodies. You can see that connection is too close for us to try to separate them superficially, and that's why I say, again, that the roots are bad and we need to dig it up. The way that I see this dysfunction actually playing out is in the relationship and power dynamics between institutional philanthropy and nonprofits or grassroots community networks. You know, I see things like foundations collecting data or stories, extracting knowledge, wisdom, creativity from Black and Brown communities without any promise or actualization of an equal return on that valuable information or that valuable wisdom. I see it where foundations will require organizations to do a whole lot of work, a whole lot of paperwork or, you know, other steps, processes in the name of accountability, but the, what they get in return are small checks that are highly restricted and don't actually enable the organization to do the work in the way that is best for them or best for their communities. And so that to me is the way that that dysfunction sort of gets expressed within our social change ecosystem. And I think another important component to remember of this, and one of the ways that we sort of fall short when we start to work on organizational change, we have to remember that organizations are comprised of people. Like, organizations don't exist without people, right? And so, you know, even though organizational structures are really what channel power and are able to move things like money and resources around, it's really the people in those organizations who have the decision-making power in order to, you know, set up those resource allocation systems. And so, I don't know, Heather, if it's time for us to get into the possibilities, but I think the fact that organizations are made up of people is one of the great possibilities of our work. And it's really, to me, about being able to shift not only the mental models and ways of viewing the world that we hold as individuals, but also to shift our relationship with one another and the power dynamics that have come to be seen as cultural norms that are actually really extractive and don't do anything to serve this vision that philanthropy says it has about a more just and equal world. So I'll just I'll pause there and yield to my other panelists.
So many great points. And you'll see that in the chat, I pull out some of the key things that our speakers will say, and I use this to put in our key takeaways. So please contribute to those because I really go through every piece of the chat. Yes, such an important point. So I love that you talked about the roots and the foundation, like the core of that is so important to interrogate and investigate and acknowledge and repair. So Tommy, I'd love you to take it away. Let us know your perspective.
Sure. You know, my context I'll speak from is very much rooted in my highest passion, which is organizing Black America for economic progress. And the focus on economics is important because the next step in our culture's maturity from fighting power to actually being power requires economic expansion and wealth as a group. So everything on the higher context in which I look at things is really rooted around this North Star of 15 trillion, really contributing to the diaspora harnessing 15 trillion of total wealth and resources. And the reason why 15 trillion is important, A, it's a score. And if you don't know the score, then the score won't change. And for the last 200 years, we've approached this thing called equality on social and moral terms. And we've made tons of progress. And all of us on this call today are primary benefactors of post-civil rights legacy. However, the next phase is rooted in economic equity. But 50 trillion is also important because we're 12% of the total population of the original people here in America. And what should I say, in these United States of aggression. And given that there's 125 trillion of baseline wealth and resources here, it's only equitable that we harness at least 12%, given that we're 12% of the population. So that would be $15 trillion. $15 trillion is also what's owed in reparations. And $15 trillion is what the commercialization of black, so-called black image, likeness, labor, and endorsement contributes to the global economy or generates for the global economy every single year. So I want to start there because if I think about the problem that we're looking to solve, at least for me, it's this historical legacy of commercial exploitation. And so much of that problem hinges on how we trade culture. When you think about how foreigners first came in contact with African culture, it's always been through trade. People coming in, dropping off items, grabbing minerals, taking them back to their country. And then somewhere along that journey, original people became the property that was actually traded. But since then, this commodification of people for profit is still the dominating colonizing values that really rule the world when we look at the structures of our hierarchies and our systems. And the work that we're doing here and the conversation that we're having now is really rooted in untangling that. Some people use the word decolonizing, which is a good word, or disruption. But it's really about, for me, I see with the work we're doing, it's looking to shift values from taking, exploiting, extracting, and instead, how can we create shared value between the commercial entity that is looking to borrow the equity of a created thing by some other culture, and restoring that equity back to the community that you're taking from. So these are the challenges that I see as an important piece of the puzzle to, A, help us get closer to $15 trillion. There's so much conversation around wealth gap, but wealth gap never really addresses the elephant in the room, is that Black culture is an asset. It produces returns. Black culture is an intellectual property. We know that culture makes profits, but those profits are monopolized. And that causes a substantial amount of harm, impacting well-being, impeding environmental safety, and perpetuating this wealth gap. So my work, my focus around trade is really rooted in bringing under control all of our assets, the things that are already producing, and creating a model in which we can actually participate in the commercialization. That alone can get up to $15 trillion quickly before we even start talking about financial literacy and being able to buy homes and investments, which is normally where that conversation goes around wealth gap. Let's take a look at what we already are producing and that we aren't actually being paid for, as Alan so eloquently said with that Staples song earlier. So commercial exploitation is the dysfunction that I'm inspired to address.
Thank you, Tony. Yeah, that $15 trillion is such a powerful number for all the different elements and what it exemplifies and what it includes. Alan, I want to hear from you.
Yeah, so I feel like there's just so much to build from Tommy and also Catherine's points. And so I'll just say that earlier in the year, last year actually, I had the opportunity to work on a lot of the federal work around the H.R. 40 bill that's up right now in Congress for reparations in America, and that bill is actually decades old. And so as I'm listening to Catherine talk about the power dynamics, in particular in a space like philanthropy, that I also share, I've been in the philanthropic space for 15 years, doing very similar work to Catherine. And so, and then listening to Tommy's points in terms of the work that Originalist Nation is doing and dedicated towards building that economic power and addressing the promise and the opportunity of what $15 trillion looks like to be able to politically have black folks, original people in America, self-govern. The resources necessary to be able to have thriving communities that are able to politically govern themselves and do so liberating themselves and liberating really all of us away from the legacy of settler colonialism and slavery, which enshrines the economic system that Catherine is speaking about, which is capitalism, which really survives off of the cultural practices of exploitation and extraction in our labor and how we produce goods and services. And so that being said, the biggest thing in this conversation about reparations that I have been a part of really all of my life, is really lifelong work, just like the other people on this panel, also as an organizer doing this work, but also as someone now who is using their organizing to really look at culture as a through line of our politics and economics, is just simply, what is reparations? I think because of the political polarization that this issue has found itself here in America as it's gained traction from the presidential debates of 2020, and seeing the momentum now of local municipalities and jurisdictions saying they're going to take on reparations, I think I get a lot of questions on, well, what does that look like in the United States when the United States has been engaged in centuries of the atrocities of the legacy of slavery and colonialism and continuing it? And it's literally in the facets of even how we create our livelihoods. And so where do we begin and where do we end? And so one of the points that I like to start with when talking about what is reparations is to talk about it from a global standpoint because of the transatlantic slave trade that I referenced earlier in pointing out the song When Will We Be Paid by the Staple Singers. And so in that global context, as the United Nations has been established, right, which also, to be mindful, is based here in the United States, the United States has played a major role in the globalization of capitalism, along with its other imperial forces that are in Europe. And so we can't have a conversation about the harms and the atrocities associated with breaking basic concerns of human rights without having a conversation about Africa. And what Tommy mentioned in terms of the ways that not only these imperialist and colonial powers pillaged resources, and we're talking about everything from spices to raw material resources, wood, you know, fish, everything, right? But also people. So the people also as property is akin to those raw material resources. So imagine not only exploiting the labor, but extracting, as Tommy mentioned, the culture of those people. And now we're acculturating ourselves to a cultural power dynamic where it's profit over people, and also it's only a few people who then have access to those resources. So that speaks to Catherine's point that she was mentioning earlier about the manifestations of philanthropy, because philanthropy as an institution is a colonial conception as well, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about having charity. We would just be thinking about communal ways of supporting each other through mutuality and reciprocity, right? So those distinctions are really important. So, you know, reparations is really a transitional justice process, right, that the United Nations puts forward in five basic principles for remedy and repair. And an organization called Project Truth, Reconciliation, and Reparations has done an amazing job at looking at other countries who have put forward remedies for right for right to remedy and repair. And so they have an analysis of in-country endeavors that have taken this on. But the five basic principles basically guarantee that there will be no repetition of said harms, that under the harms identified, that there's actually direct compensation and restitution. So another example is, you know, I'm in Inglewood, California. I'm sure folks may have heard of the news of the what happened in Manhattan Beach, where land was taken by eminent domain from a black family who owned a parcel of land right near Manhattan Beach called Bruce's Beach of the Bruce's family. That land was just returned by the state of California, and the county facilitated that because they were the ones who held ownership and custodialship of the land, and that land has now been returned back to the family. So as part of reparations, there's actually a restitution and a compensation process for those peoples who were the recipients of the harm caused, right? The third one is based on making sure that there's satisfaction under international law. So I mentioned earlier in that song, like it's not just about being paid, but it's about what we're owed to each other. And I think in talking about the emotional and mental suffering for generations that have been impacted by the harms and the legacy of slavery and settler colonialism, it's the reasons why we're having decades upon hundreds of years of conversation about the disparities that black people face, not only here in America, but across the globe, because of the conception of poverty and wealth under a colonial and imperialist system. And then lastly, what does it mean to then rehabilitate? Right? In the healing and the redemption, what does it mean to provide the legal, medical, psychological services and structures of care that, an example, in the United States, are not a part of the ways that we construct livelihood collectively. In our policies, we don't incentivize people, institutions, and structures to be able to create communal structures of care, wealth building, and the like. And so what are going to be the rehabilitative processes and policies that go alongside a reparations process that will get us there? And so ultimately, if we're talking about a process of reparations and creating remedies, it means that we want to be able to, in a United States context, really shift away from a political system where only few get to participate and make decisions, and away from a capitalist economic system that then says we will continue to extract and exploit each other in order to make a living, you know, which is like crazy making even as I say it. But reparations in the process would have us then say, what does it mean to liberate ourselves from those things and create systems and structures that are really human-centered and designed, right? Rather than prioritizing the profits and said resources over people and really continuating the legacy of slavery and settler colonialism. So to me, that's like the biggest, you know, challenge and debate that I engage in spaces where local municipalities, private companies, nonprofits, and governments at the state level are engaging in around what are reparations and what is the process in which we're going to facilitate being reparative in making sure that we create different ways of being in systems that are really going to support and fuel us, especially during a time where we're dealing with multiple pandemics and other political atrocities that are continuing to happen.
Thank you for clarifying the different elements of reparations. I think it's so helpful. And could you put in the chat the link for the Project Truth Reconciliation so people can look at that site? That would be great. Thank you. And for any of you that have questions that are popping up for you, please start putting them into the chat, and we'll ask those in the Q&A. So we want to transition to our next question, which is more of a conversation between our three guests. What's emerging that gives you hope? Catherine already started talking about some of the hope of the individual transformation, the individual, the people that make up systems and organizations, right? They're not just these sort of robotic entities. So I would love, Catherine, if you could speak more about that. What are you seeing that gives you hope that it is possible for change to address appropriation, to address reparations? What would you say?
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to touch on a few different things here, but I think the common thread is that we have to begin to really grapple with power and what our sources of power are. I think as a community organizer, I learned to have a very sort of strong orientation towards power and began learn to look at it as something that I already have and that is it's not zero sum. So just because I have a lot of it doesn't mean that no one else does. And I don't think that that is a common orientation towards power. But I'm gonna first give us some ways to think about what power is, and then I'm gonna answer your question, Heather, about what is emerging that gives me hope. So one way that I like to think about power is that power is the product of relationships. And so when you think about the ways that our relationships to one another and the ways that we can share resources, share community, share care for one another can generate more of the same, I like to really remind myself that power is a product of relationships. Another definition of power that I like to use is that power defines the rules. And I say this a lot to my colleagues in philanthropy. They're here writing rules about how this money gets distributed, and they could today decide to write new rules, right? And so just as a way to remind those with a lot of institutional or concentrated power that, that you know, you have the opportunity to determine how this game gets played. And then the final thing I'll share, and this will kind of lead me into my hopes for the future, is that power is organized people, organized money, and organized ideas, right? And so if we can think about power in those three sort of constructions, it helps, you know, give us a framework for what I see emerging in this conversation about reparations, especially in the nonprofit philanthropic ecosystem. So the first thing that gives me hope is, again, that institutions are comprised of people, and people thrive on relationships, and relationships channel power, right? So when I'm working with organizations, especially with people in philanthropic institutions, I really focus in on the one-on-one relationship. And I don't care if I'm working with the CEO or if I'm working with the IT coordinator. I'm always looking for an opportunity to unlock that internal revolution. The first revolution is internal, is another thing that I was taught as a community organizer. And I believe that if we can get to a place where each person is really consciously examining their own biases, their own mindsets, their own worldviews, and then using that discovery process to transfer what they're learning and this sort of awakening this new awareness to others through their relationships, that's how we begin to shift systems over time. And it really speaks to what I think Alan mentioned this, this idea about shifting values and ideas really begins with the individual and then flows out into relationships. And I have seen in my work with organizations, with leaders, especially in philanthropy, that internal sort of awareness that people have when they begin to question, what's wrong with this system? Why does this feel so extractive? Why does this feel so exploitative? And they really start to dig into what values are being violated by the systems that they're in. Then they can begin to shift the way that they relate to other people. And that has a very powerful, powerful ripple effect. So you know, being able to focus in on that and shift people's ideas about how they relate to not only each other, but to their institutions and to the world around them, give me a lot of hope as a coach and consultant. Another thing that gives me hope relates to this idea that power can define the rules. And in the institutional philanthropy space, I am hopeful that more and more organizations are beginning to see where they can just decide to do things differently, right? They can just decide that we're not going to have small grassroots networks or nonprofits write like super excruciatingly long grants in order to get $10,000. We're just going to give them $10,000 because we trust that they know what to to do to serve their community, and because we as philanthropy have the same interests, like we want their communities to be healthy, we want their communities to be thriving, we're just going to trust them to do that work. We're going to give them what they need to do the work. And I think that, you know, there's a long way to go for large philanthropic institutions to have that kind of trust. But again, I do think it begins with shifting your values and your mindsets around whose money is this, right? Who do these resources actually belong to? And letting that awareness ripple throughout the organization. The final thing that gives me hope is that I believe that, you know, social change is an accumulation of lots and lots and lots of small choices, and that each person within an organization or within an ecosystem has the ability to make certain choices that will either perpetuate the status quo of extraction or disrupt the status quo and, you know, pave a path towards reparation and healing and liberation. And there's a tool from Race Forward called Equity Choice Points that I use a lot when I'm working with organizations. And it's just based on this idea that when we begin to make shifts in sort of the least explicit conditions for system change, we can have the greatest impact. And the least explicit conditions for system change are mental models, power dynamics, and relationships. You start to get more explicit with policy change and process and budgets and things like that, and all of that's really important. But I believe that the greatest opportunity for transformation comes when we focus on doing our own work, liberating ourselves from these colonial mindsets that Alan talked about, and then working to consciously shift through our choices and everyday interactions, the relationships that we have with others and the power imbalances that exist that might be hard to see until we see them. But once we see them, we can't ignore it. And to that point, if we're going to be sort of making the implicit more explicit, right? If we're going to be making power dynamics and relationship dynamics more explicit, we've got to be talking about race, right? Like, this is one thing that I'm always telling my partners in philanthropy, like, you can't have a structural shift in your organization towards equity and not be willing to be explicit about the way that race and racism functions in your organization. And, you know, there's a lot of writers, a lot of thinkers around racial politics that say that race is a fiction that is real, right? And so even though, you know, this concept of race is something that we just sort of made up socially, it might as well be real. And until it's no longer a widely accepted social construction, we've got to just be able to name it. And so that's just one part of our ability to make the implicit conditions for change more explicit, is being able to talk explicitly about race. So I think that those are some of my thoughts. I would really be curious to hear Alan and Tommy's reactions or thoughts or anything else you have to add.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, Alan or Tommy, jump in. Like, what gives you hope? What are you seeing in the future? What are you seeing as the possibility? Either one of you, hop right in and unmute.
I feel like I'm going to be like Anansi the Spider, you know, who's another, you know, Akan, Ashanti, trickster, and in many ways part of like the West African cosmology is really popular as a quote-unquote fictional character, but I feel like he is very spiritual in nature and teaches us a lot about the solutions that we can find in problems that we happen to come across in our lives. And I really appreciate Tommy's and also Catherine's distinctions that are being made in talking about the power dynamics as it pertains to equity and equality, because I feel like there's a lot in hope and promise in the consciousness of our people who are gaining much more awareness between the distinctions of the two, and how we can begin to practice being in right stewardship culturally with each other and to the land that we're on. You know, it's like one thing to do the land acknowledgments. It's another to then think about what is the history of the Tongva people and many tribal nations here in Turtle Island, right, and in other places where we may go and visit and build relationships and be with people, especially with the advent of all this technology online and the evolution of Web 3.0. You know, there are all these ways that we're connecting that are also surfacing new problems that we need to be able to address that are creating new inequities and disparities. And as Catherine mentioned, those things are very much about race, because the minute we start talking about capitalism, capitalism in and of itself is racialized. And you can look at the work of Robin D.G. Kelly and others who talk about this. Sokwe Carmichael, otherwise known as Kwame Ture, talks about this. And so I really think in the context of reparations, it is imperative that we have an understanding about the distinctions between the two, because then we will create false solutions for the problems that have been a part of this nation for hundreds of years, and we'll continue to use that as the excuse as to why we can't get to a different kind of condition that will keep us well in the midst of all of the chaos that we've created as a nation. So I feel like from the distinctions of having a greater consciousness of what it means to own the means of one's production and to steward those resources responsibly, and to be able to gain the surplus from those resources once they're commodified, to be able to redistribute those things equitably is part of an equity conversation, right? Because under capitalism, I can also say, I want the same amount of money and the same amount of wealth as a white man who works at a Fortune 500 company. And from an equality standpoint, that may be true. It's like, yes, we should have equal and the same as people as far as race and gender is concerned. But the deeper thing to interrogate is, how did I actually get to that $100 million that I made this year? And if I made it off the backs of people's labor who are not being compensated equitably, who do not have health care, who are underinsured or not insured at all, who are unemployed, we have a problem, right? There's something with our economic system, and because of the way our economic system operates, our political and cultural ways that we operate need to be interrogated too. So we need to move from a space of being in competition in the marketplace to one of collaboration and cooperation, where we can find alignment in how we create our livelihoods, especially during this pandemic. My mom is retired. You know, she was working for Kaiser Permanente and all these people, and it was the first time I saw her, you know, creating local economy in her house. She was selling masks. She was growing fruits and vegetables in her backyard. So when I hear Tommy talking about being, you know, an urban naturalist, I'm like, yo, that's dope. That's refreshing to hear, you know, because it's the healing that our folks deserve, especially since they were tilling, our generations of people tilling the soil, working on land for free. And now in this generation, to have folks be able to say, you know, I enjoy being in nature, and not have being in nature attached to, I'm working for somebody to produce a thing, talks about the piece you mentioned earlier, Heather, around what does it mean for us to tell our stories so that we can be in our full humanity, right? So that's why we're in these conversations. So to me, that gives me hope. The promise and the opportunity of raising people's consciousness to be in a practice of equity, justice, and liberation, right? Equality is a starting place to invite people in, but ultimately we want to get people into what is the consciousness and practice, your daily lifestyle of how you live your life in a way that stands in equity, justice, and liberation. Because the only way we're going to engage in a process of reparations if we actually stand in that and practice that. But standing in a conversation around equality is not going to address the racial wealth gap. And I'll tell you that right now, because with the tax code that we have in this current economic system, we will actually enshrine philanthropy until the end of days. So if we're serious about it, then it means all of us have a responsibility to be in right stewardship culturally, politically, and economically to each other. And my friend Beatrice Anderson has a really lovely TED Talk that talks about what are the practices daily that we can engage in our lives to be in right stewardship to each other. So I'm going to put that in the chat for folks to be able to listen to. And then also my good friend Trevor Smith, who is at the organization I helped build as a senior fellow at PolicyLink when I entered into the work around reparations and learning more about the latest and greatest that are happening, that's happening locally on the ground and in states that are enacting reparations processes. And his blog is called Reparations Daily-ish. So you can sign up for his Substack account because he's engaging in a narrative change initiative on reparations as we speak.
I love Trevor's emails. Yes, definitely sign up. Check out those resources. That's fantastic. I love all the things that you've shared so far, and the resources are so important for all of us to go deeper. Tommy, I want to hear.
Those shares are high power. Thank you all for your contributions. The smoke is here. That gives me hope with a few things. On a most basic level, we're in the age of Aquarius. And an age lasts 2,600 years. We just started this age in 2013. So we're not even 10 years in yet. An age of Aquarius is all about raising consciousness. So all of us around the world are intuitively inspired to be more conscious about our choices, about our intentions, about our motivations for doing things. Age of Aquarius is also inspiring us to want to be more communal in how we operate and how we function. But it's in this consciousness that is sparing this through line that everyone is speaking to, which is values. So there's some values that uphold colonization. And to disrupt that, I look at the core values to be more restorative and repairing must be rooted in trust. And trust can be expressed through acknowledgement and language. And then the second value being reciprocity. What is that exchange? Is that exchange equitable? How is that exchange happening in a restorative manner? Because right now, free enterprise permits the values of oppressive economy. It permits that. There's no consequence. There's no fine for continuing to oppress. It's just become normal. And like any abnormality that's done over time, it becomes normal. So as I focus this value change around trade, the thing that gives me hope is we are the solutions. We are the ones to bring the solutions to this table now, and improving our trade practices, shifting from extractive and exploitative trade practices that do not acknowledge, that do not exhibit reciprocity in an economic form, to what I call ethical trade. And ethical trade is simply about acknowledging the stakeholders that are involved with creating a thing, and profit sharing, which is the reciprocity, being able to have a mechanism to profit share equitably back to those communities that are being extracted from. Because the reality is original people are not the only ones that are impacted by oppressive economy. It's just that the level of extraction for our culture has been the most heinous and has been the most wealth building when we look at what it actually has done for the global economy. My work as a problem solver and as creating a solution is leveraging technology to do this. So I'm a founder and CEO of Made with Black Culture, and we are an ethical trade tech company that mints, authenticates all products that are made using the image, likeness, labor, or endorsement of Black culture. So the same way you see an organic symbol on some bananas, or you see a kosher food symbol on some water to help you be able to trust that, that was created with the standards and how that product is being handled, in a way that's caring and equitable. What we've done is created a framework to help corporations validate their commercial use of Black culture using a blockchain watermarking system that stamps all products, digital or physical, that have been created using the creativity, likeness, or endorsement of Black culture. And what this stamp is really about is being a vehicle for ethical trade. Because what the stamp does is when you see it, it's attached to some socialization visual data where when you scan it, you'll be able to see all of the stakeholders in the supply chain who lent their creativity, lent their sauce, lent their innovation to the creation of this product. So you can actually see it and see that there's real people that are behind these products. The second thing it does is it ensures that these stakeholders, both private and public, are paid royalties so that there can be some form of honorable exchange. And the final piece that the technology does is take a percentage of the net profits from this produced thing and funnels it back into areas that are going to public service areas that are going to truly improve the condition of original people. I call it mutual aid programs. So this is my way, our team's way of creating a solution to the way trade is happening, but specifically to have a way to change the way the world is participating with Black culture. Because right now, as it stands, we have a world that loves to consume a highly monetized Black culture, yet Black culture itself is starving economically. So shifting that from being a grossly exploitative practice to more of a transformative and restorative practice hinges on ethical trade. And that's the thing that gives me hope. And what also gives me hope is that collectively, and when I think about consumers, because addressing racial equity through the lens of consumerism is a very poignant touch point that connects with everybody. Because as I mentioned, it's always been through trade. How people subscribe to culture now is by buying things. I buy that shirt because I subscribe to that culture. I buy this music because I subscribe to that culture. I move in this neighborhood because I subscribe to that culture. So we all are purchasing and participating in culture and creating a mechanism to funnel that consumerism impact back to the culture that we are participating in is one way to help us begin to level the playing field and improve our ultimate condition. So I'm hopeful about that. I'm hopeful about that we're in a space now where people have real values. People really care about the products they're consuming. They want to know what's behind it, who created it, where did it come from. So just that alone, like anything, once you have awareness of the thing, auto correction happens automatically once there's awareness. So I'm really inspired by the state of the consciousness of the globe. The fact that this conversation that we're having now is evidence that there's some values changing, that people are interested in actually getting this and auto-correcting this in a way that's going to be equitable and creating shared value for all parties involved. And that would be my thing that I'm most hopeful for. And I'm inspired because we all have the ability to impact this in our own way, through our own daily practices, through our own corporate practices, through our own philanthropic practices. We can exhibit and express these new values of trust and reciprocity in everything that we do.
Thank you, Tommy. So good. I love what the three of you have brought to this conversation, from the what the individual can do with our consumerism, our awareness, our consciousness, their reconnection to our values and asking those questions. But what can we do as organizations? What can we do as countries, as a global network, a global community? I love that you've touched on all areas. While our speakers collect their thoughts, I'm just going to talk about the next episode, just to let you know what to look forward to that I think is a great follow-on to this conversation. I have too many things open. Can you see that? So Chuck is not a friend yet, but Jennifer and Kenesha are such great friends that I've just been trying to find ways to, again, like, have them come together to this community. So we're going to be continuing this conversation about policies and programs will result in the just transfer of wealth. And so I think it's a great secondary conversation. So I'm going to stop sharing and put in the chat a link to register. And then I will also, in the thank you email that you'll get, it will have all the links to all the different resources, key takeaways, and the place to register for the next episode. So join the LinkedIn group. I'll put that Google Doc back in here. Join the LinkedIn group. Engage. Support our speakers. I'll ask each of our speakers to give a link where we can support their work. So please, if you feel like you have financial capacity and want to do that, please do that. You can support Possibility Project. That's awesome, too. But I'm so glad that you're here, and I hope you continue to engage with this community and come back for more. So I want to hear from our speakers. Anyone jump in. What are some parting words that you have for us in these last couple minutes before we go back to our days?
I'll kick off. Thank you, Heather, again, for creating and holding the space for all of us to just wrestle with these ideas. One of the things that came up in my breakout group was, you know, how do we persist through this age that, you know, that we're in, that Tommy spoke about so brilliantly, this age of transformation. And one of the ways that I remind myself of you know, the need to keep going is just by recognizing, you know, I don't have enough power to transform things that are happening all around the world or all around the country, but I do have an incredible amount of power and influence in my home, with my child, with other children that I take care of. I have an incredible amount of influence with my neighbors and my most proximate community, and with those clients that I work with and people that I coach. And I believe that the, the transfer of energy is a real thing. And by continuing to do my own work of healing and liberation and by encouraging that in other people, I do think that, you know, over the course of this challenging age that we're in, we will begin to see transformation. So that's my hopeful takeaway that I hope is helpful to some of you.
I love that. Definitely transfer of energy. Yes, for sure. Tommy or Alan, want to jump in?
Sure. I would, I guess my final word would be restore. And I think that's something that we all can take and embody in our daily lives, because restoring is really rooted in approaching things from a perspective of how can I replenish? How can I add value? And all of this is a function of reciprocity, but I think that mindset, that mindfulness, that kind of energy and approach to everything, whether I'm visiting a friend's home, and I'm thinking, man, how can I add value to this space? Or whether I'm working on a project collectively in partnership with another entity, how can I restore equity back to the thing that we're producing or creating together would be my takeaway. Because I think it's in that mindfulness that we can start healing and start better acknowledging each other and treating each other better by having that mindset of how can I add value to this person, this being, this entity in a way that is restorative.
I love that. That's going to become a sticky note that I go back to. That's so powerful. Alan.
Yeah, I feel like in my conversation with Kyla, we were talking really, I feel like, about accountability in very loving, kind, and very affirming, and then also very direct, you know, ways. And it makes me think of the work that Zeal has been working on for the past 3 years on a cultural strategy platform that is called Who Owns Black Art. We launched an exhibition on it about 3 years ago, and we're getting ready to launch our second volume of it this year at Art Basel in Miami. But we talked about in our group, even sometimes we don't recognize the moments where we may be giving our power away, because we're not well informed about the actual access to power and the assets that are available to us. And so we talked about treaties, we talked about contracts as it pertained to land, and assessing, like, there are parcels of land that actually are not owned by, you know, private entities or by government. And so where are we as people self-organizing to be able to take hold of that? The same thing in arts and culture. We're having conversations about the cultural reclamation of stolen artifacts across the African diaspora. And so where are those moments to be able to engage and organize around those assets without having to go through illegitimate processes that are legitimized by imperialist and colonial forces? Where can we actually reclaim power there and move forward powerfully and really creating spaces of accountability so that processes of reparations can occur and not do so from a place of assuming that these so-called legitimate processes need to be enacted and that we need to follow them, that they actually should be broken because they're illegitimate, and actually many of them have broken consent of our free will anyway. So it was really interesting to be in that conversation with Kyla, especially as we are closing out this conversation on appropriation and reparation. So those are going to be my closing thoughts in terms of what came out from our group.
So powerful. Oh, thank you, Catherine, Tommy, and Alan. I told y'all, like, individually, amazing forces, and the three of you together was just fantastic. I love how these conversations come together and so powerfully, and you all are just amazing. And thank you all for being here, and please join us for future episodes. You'll now get those emails when they're ready, and follow us all on LinkedIn to see when the action's happening. And I hope this has planted many seeds and reaffirmed thoughts you already have, and that you feel supported to keep focusing on that individual revolution that you can start with. And thank you all so much. I hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the fourth lecture in our Reparations Speaker Series hosted by the Psychiatry Department of Yale School of Medicine. My name is Christopher Fields, a postdoc in the department, and I will moderate the Q&A. Today we have Yvette Carnell, a nationally recognized reparations advocate and founder of hashtag ADOS, American Descendants of Slavery. We ask that you keep your questions to the Q&A at the end. If you would like to ask a question, please raise your hand and you will be unmuted. You can also ask your question anonymously via chat. First, Dr. Kevin Cosby, president of Simmons College of Kentucky, which is the oldest HBCU in the state of Kentucky, will introduce Yvette Carnell. Dr. Cosby, in addition to leading Simmons College of Kentucky, is also the senior pastor of St. Stephen Baptist Church, which has the largest African-American congregation in the state of Kentucky. Simmons College of Kentucky and St. Stephen Church have a record of engaging with reparations scholarship, one example being the Angela Project, a three-year conference on reparations, which culminated on the 400th year commemoration of slavery in America in 2019. The Angela Project was named after the first enslaved person to step off the slave ship in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619. We're very grateful and honored to have Dr. Cosby introducing Yvette Carnell. Dr. Cosby?
Thank you, Christopher, and I consider it a signature honor to introduce one of the most consequential voices in the history of Black America. I will give you her formal visa resume, and then I will make a very brief personal comment about our speaker. Yvette Carnell is the founder of the weekly political show Breaking Brown and is also a writer of politics, race, and wealth. She is the originator of the hashtag ADOS, American Descendants of Slavery, and her show was critical to making reparations a policy platform for the 2019 Democratic primary debates. Before embarking on a career in news media, she served as a congressional aide, first to Senator Barbara Boxer, and later to former Congressman Marion Barry. Yvette has been featured by national news outlets, including, but not limited to, The Nation, The Guardian, Politico, Philadelphia Inquirer, Vox, The Intercept, ABC, NPR, and CNN's United Shades of America with Camus Bell. Yvette received a BA in political science from Howard University. I might add that a leader is someone, first of all, who is going somewhere. And secondly, a leader is someone who is able to inspire others to go with them. The most consequential issue in Black America today is the issue of reparations. All other issues are subordinate to this preeminent issue. And what Frederick Douglass was to abolitionism and Ida B. Wells was to the issue of lynching, and Martin Luther King Jr. was to the issue of civil rights and social justice, I would submit to you that our speaker today, Yvette Carnell, will go down in the annals of history as the most important voice for the advocacy of the American descendants of slavery on the issue of reparation. It is with great pride, and I consider, as I said before, a signature honor to introduce to you our speaker, my teacher and friend, Yvette Carnell.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir, so much for that. And I want to thank Yale, and I want to thank everyone who is here to participate in what we're discussing today. And I think one of the things that I think and that I believe is that everyone here believes they're here to hear a speech about reparations or a speech about race. But what you're really here to hear is a speech about misunderstandings. And there are some very clear misunderstandings that have led us to this space that we're here right now. So as I begin this, what I want to talk about just very briefly is my own journey into those kinds of misunderstandings around race and around freedom. And when I graduated from Howard University, as Dr. Cosby just said, I believed, as so many other ADOS believe, that you can do anything, you can be anything, because that is kind of what we have been fed. That is kind of what the media teaches us, right? Is that we can be the Cosbys. Everything is about you can work hard enough. Even our own heroes told us that. They said that Booker T. Washington said, you cast down your bucket and you do the work and you become American. When I left school, I went to work on Capitol Hill. One of the things that I found there is that there were certain, again, misunderstandings. So I'm not saying good things cannot happen there and good things should not happen there, but what I saw happening there was accommodation, was accommodationist policies as opposed to transformative policies that were meant to build ADOS into the real fabric of America that has to do with wealth. It's not just about empathy in terms of how a white person or a person of color thinks about us. It is about whether or not you have the wealth to be American. So you begin to understand that this whole framework is built on a series of misunderstandings and that we are dealing with certain symptoms of a disease as opposed to the disease. And how we understand that disease is a misunderstanding. You see, one of the misunderstandings, even when we talked about Booker T. Washington, we have to talk about do-for-selferism. Right? This idea that we can lift ourselves up. Nixon was a proponent of that. And there were a lot of people who got involved in that and said, these people can lift themselves up. And we tried to do that. And then what happened, we ran straight into white monopolies who shut us out because they get to decide who buys and who sells. That's what they do. It's a misunderstanding to see this just in terms of money, just in terms of a check. When you go back to the Kerner Report, what the Kerner Report tells us is that, hey, this group is going to become a bottom caste. We're developing a caste system. Yet and still, we went and made the Cosby Show, and we promoted this idea of meritocracy, and we did not discuss the true reality of the fact that ADOS are a bottom caste because this country needs somebody to eat the failure. There has to be a group that has the nuclear facility, that has the liquor stores, that eats the subprime mortgage and feeds into white capital. Again, it's another misunderstanding that race is just sort of a happenstance, that the creation of race is just something that happens as opposed to something that was created, built, and weaponized against a group of people to remain on the bottom. Again, a misunderstanding that we have about who we are and what it means in terms of getting to that next level, in terms of what reparations means. So in order to move past the misunderstandings, we have to understand them and we have to unlearn. Learning is one thing. Unlearning the misunderstandings that we have is another thing altogether. Our politics are arranged by a specific kind of hierarchy. At the very bottom of that hierarchy, tethered to the bottom, like the Kerner Report said, is ADOS. And especially what you get when you read Thomas Piketty, what you begin to understand is there's no way for labor in terms of how money is going all the way to the top. Even look at what Jeff Bezos is worth now. Look at what kind of a multi-billionaire he is now. That money goes all the way to the top, and we're still tethered to the bottom, and we eat the failure, and he eats the wealth. And so the idea that labor, we can get out of here by labor. You can get a good job. You can get a good college. That's not what happens. You have this idea of plugs and outlets. So what happens to ADOS is that we go to school, we go to college, as did I and a lot of ADOS, and some don't because we don't have the, we come from crumbling schools, right? We live in neighborhoods where have been replaced by charter schools. So we don't have that. But even when we have the plug, like we have the plug in our hand, there is no outlet to plug that into. And so the life that we have lived and have been encouraged to live, even when we do reach the pinnacle of ADOS success, is a lie. And so that is a misunderstanding of our exchange in America. And it goes all the way back to Booker. It goes all the way back to the Great Migration when they said, well, the KKK is killing you here, but if you just move west, move to Chicago, or wherever, you can have a better life. Well, we moved there, and we find that there were white mobs, a lot of times ethnic mobs, who treated us just as bad as anyone else and bombed us out of our homes and took what we had. So this country has left us running. And so in the essence, the Cosby Show is a kind of misunderstanding, and it's a kind of social engineering. It's just one of many that creates in the mind of not only us as ADOS, it creates in the mind of you and those of you who are other people of color or white America, that this thing is possible for ADOS, but it's not, because we're tethered to the bottom for a very specific reason. And if you don't understand that, what you have is a misunderstanding. When we talk about the plunder of land, we all know, and if you don't know, you can absolutely look that up. But our land was stripped from us. Our land was robbed from us, and it was never given back. Nobody ever made us whole in any kind of way. So when Booker T says, cast down your bucket, I say, Booker T, on what land? Because that land was stripped away from us intentionally and methodically. We all know that the Confederates were able to get back. They were able to get back their wealth within a generation after being traitors to the country. That land was supposed to be redistributed to us, and it never happened. There has been a misunderstanding in terms of who we are, how we got here, and what needs to happen in order to make us whole. So before I even get to the part where we talk about reparations, we have to talk about the misunderstanding that we can somehow start from zero. We can start from today, knowing what we know about the data, that we're going to go to zero wealth as a group by 2053, that we can start today and somehow build. That's not possible if nobody makes up for the plunder. That's not possible if nobody pays us back. That's not possible if we try to depend on labor to make that happen because there's not enough money in labor. The money has gone all the way up to the top. That's not possible if you try to fix race with class. You cannot fix what has happened to us. through a generalized kind of uplift of all people. That's not possible. And if you believe that, that is another kind of misunderstanding. 40% of all the homeless, we make up 40% of all the homeless and 52% of all the homeless families as ADOS. That's us. That's because we're tethered to the bottom. And what we're talking about when we talk about reparations is whether or not we survive in this country or whether or not we perish. Because what you – and understand that these numbers are pre-COVID. Post-COVID is even worse than this in terms of what has happened to the ADOS community, because we don't have wealth transfers. We don't have generational wealth. Nobody can float us $1,000 or $2,000 for rent. Nobody can float us anything. And that is kind of the captured group that we are. So when you look at it, when you think about it, when you think about the bottom 50% of ADOS are worth less than a dollar in this very rich and affluent country that we built, because what ADOS really means when you talk about it, we're talking about a very specific contribution to this country and a very specific kind of oppression. And that oppression goes all the way from slavery to redlining to reconstruction. That goes all the way through mass incarceration. That's where we go. That's a very specific kind of oppression. And the Kerner Report said you have to do something transformative about this. And nothing transformative has happened. So the idea that we can kind of do it ourselves or we can use class to do it is, again, a misunderstanding. So what I'm here today to do is kind of clear up a large amount of misunderstanding. We have even much misunderstand who we are, right? So we're not just black in terms of melanin. The reason we don't have inheritance is not because of blackness. It's not because of melanin. It's because of who we are in terms of. My mother worked on a sharecropper farm. I'm a light-skinned person, so it's not about melanin. It's about the lineage that I have and what I don't have because of how my family and my lineage was broken up. It's because of, at the beginning of that story that I told you about Howard University, it's because of what I recognize because of who I am and where I come from, that this stuff isn't going to work. What they're doing in terms of moving the chairs around and one chair gets a new pillow, that's not going to work. So we have to unlearn and deal with all the misunderstandings that we have had in order to move forward in terms of this conversation. People talk about a racial wealth gap, but it's really a lineage wealth gap. Because you have in the color of, if you look at the color of wealth Miami, if you look at that study, if you look at the study, the color of wealth in LA, what you find is that even black immigrants in those countries, or will they be first in or second gen, they're doing better than us because failure is not baked into who they are. That is not who they are. And there are studies that show there's a preference for them because they know that they don't carry the same baggage and the same claim that we have. So this is not a melanin-based conversation. This is about a very specific group that is owed a very specific thing. You know, I talk about all the time, you know, it takes much longer to heal a wound than inflict a wound. So, you know, you all, I broke my ankle playing basketball, right? And you all know that it took seconds. I heard my ankle snap, pop, and I was out, right? Didn't feel anything till later because the body has a lot of ways of covering up you being real messed up. So I didn't feel it, but that was what it was. It took me months to heal that ankle. So what we're talking about in terms of reparations for ADOS, we're not talking about a one-time cash out and move on, because that's a way that white supremacy and white supremacists will say, well, hey, look, we gave them some money. It's finished. We're talking about a multi-generational project to fix a group that America as a country decided that was going to be on the bottom, was going to build the country, and was going to be the garbage disposal for this country. It's going to take a lot longer to fix that wound than it did to inflict it. This is not about a one-time cash payout. Now, wealth is a part of this. You have to give wealth because wealth was taken away. But there also have to be protections in place to make sure that capital can't just come into our communities and get that wealth back from us, right, through consumerism. So if you don't open up the doors to ownership so we can be a part of the ownership class, if you don't protect us, look at what happened in the subprime mortgage, right, under Obama, first black president, not ADOS president, but you see what happened with him in terms of not really holding the banks accountable for how they did that. Banks are drivers of wealth. That's kind of what they do. That's part of their business. We cannot be locked out of that part of wealth and wealth building, but that is exactly what is happening, and that is exactly what has happened, and it has happened for 400 years. So when I think about it, I'm not just here to have a conversation about reparations and what that looks like. I have to do as my charge to help you understand the misunderstandings that led us to this place, to believe that this was not due or that there's some other way to do it. What we're faced with now is the realization that America is not built on wealth now. America is built on wealth, but it's not built on income. America is built on wealth and intergenerational transfers. And in that kind of scheme, we fail. There's nothing we can do but fail, because all of our wealth, intellectual property, everything that we have had has been stripped from us. So in order to make us whole as a group, the thing that has to happen, when I talk about that wound that was inflicted, it has to be healed. And that healing has to be multi-generational. It would make no sense to have several generations tethered to the bottom and oppressed and abused by America, and then say to yourself or to me or to anyone else that we're just going to drop a bunch of money on this one generation and call it quits. This is going to be a very complicated and complex process. That's just what it is. And there's no way around that. And it's going to be the next generation and the next, because we have to close. People say the racial wealth gap is really a lineage wealth gap, but we have to close that gap, and you have to pour resources into this community until that gap is closed. You have to pour protections in terms of policy into this community until that gap is closed. You have to do the work until that gap is closed. And I will point to the Jewish community in terms of the Holocaust. They don't just give resources and money and help to people who were in the Holocaust. They give to their descendants because they're considered to be standing in the shoes. And what we would say here today is that ADOS is standing in the shoes, and there has to be a multi-generational, because we're going to have to tweak this as we go. There are some things that are going to have to change. There are some things we have to have wealth, and we have to have certain protections, and there has to be within our policy framework some way to make that happen in a way that not only protects us and our wealth, but kind of ensures that we are taking, incentivizes business as well to take us into that framework and say, hey, you didn't get this. We're gonna give this to you. There's a credit for this. There's a tax credit for that, because there has to be a way to build us into the ownership class. And so I kind of take issue to people say, well, it's just a check or it's just this. No, it's not just one thing. It's a lot of things that go together. It is a robust reparations plan that we're looking for. It's not something I've seen people write and experts in the field write that it's going to be a 15-year plan. And I think that is highly irresponsible, because it has to be a generational plan, right? It has to be, you know, when you look at this, let me just read something. In 1962, there's $470 billion of household wealth. By 1980, it's $11 trillion. Today, it's over $100 trillion in household wealth, nearly entirely held in white hands. White America has locked in their privileges and sold us, and sold us Cosby and LeBron James to kind of take away from the fact that those, the rest of us, have nothing. And we have been so embarrassed about having nothing that we have not shared that with anyone. And we have kind of just, you know, kept our pain to ourselves while we're on the verge of a $70 trillion transfer of from white boomers to their children. And our parents have nothing to transfer. And that transfer was stolen, and that transfer was plundered. And so what has to happen now is that there has to be, you know, we tried everything else. You see that money is about to be passed down from white boomers and to their children. And some of that is being passed down now thanks to COVID. We tried do for selfism. We tried black business. You ate us up. You gobbled us up. Stole our intellectual property. There's nothing, absolutely nothing, that has not been tried by us, and it doesn't work. So we are back to reparations. You all remember when the general had to come to the black people and say, I know I promised y'all 40 acres and a mule. And thanks to Andrew Johnson, that president at that time, none of that happened. That's the consequence of politics. We didn't get what we were owed. We didn't get what we were due. And when we tried to do it, even in terms of land, that land was stripped away from us. We were great at farming. Like if you know, even when people talk about agribusiness, great at all of that. But you can't do it if your own government weaponizes itself against you. And that has been the story of our existence here. So when I talk to Yale and when I talk to the people in this room, what I'm saying to you is that this is a multi-generational project, that we need the people who are at the helm of academia to quantify, right, to qualify, to put this, we have a lot of data right now, to put this all together, to put a cost to it, and decide how we are going to use this bill that we build as a reparations bill, right, to actually redistribute wealth in a way that protects ADOS and finally pays us to do that America promised us a long time ago that it never gave us. And if we don't have that, when we talk about urgency, if we don't have that, it's not hyperbolic for me to say that we're finished. There will be diversity in your new, there will be diversity. There will be people that come from other countries who are brown. There will be black people who look like us who don't come from what we come from around you, but it won't be us. And you will have shut out us, and you will have kind of relegated us to poverty and homelessness if you don't take seriously a reparations project that makes us whole. And that's why I'm here, because Yale is the place where you all, in terms of what you do and how you do it, and you're the best at doing it in terms of, everybody knows Yale and Harvard, right? So you all are essential in terms of how this project works and what you're willing to contribute to. What I've said before is a multi-generational project, and we have to have it, because we can't exist without intergenerational wealth transfers. And we've already done a reparations bill in terms of an ADOS chapter in California. We've already done that. But those who are serious about reparations need to get on board with us and help us, because you have tools that we don't have, and we need to work together in order to make that happen. And if it doesn't happen, ADOS is in for a lot of trouble. You'll have black people, but it won't be people who come from chattel slavery. So I just want to end it there, and I want to thank you, Chris.
Thank you so much for that powerful talk, Ms. Cornell. Now I would like to open it up for Q&A. So as stated earlier, if you would like to speak your question, please raise your hand. We will unmute you. You can also post your question anonymously in the chat. And I guess I'll start it off to reiterate your point that it takes longer to heal a wound than inflict it. How do you visualize, outside it being a multi-generational project, are there other dimensions that are important to focus on outside of economics? How important is, there are some people who are maybe trying to decenter the economic portion of reparations. How important is it to center the economics? And what do you envision as a comprehensive reparations project? What would that look like?
Well, that would look, it would be so, I don't think anybody's ever built a bill like what I have in my mind. So let me just say that. In the sense of, there has to be a wealth transfer, right? But you also have to have protections. One of the things that has happened in America, even when you look back to federal housing and that sort of thing. You saw them say, like, you can have this. You saw the Supreme Court said you can't do this. And then nobody protected us because politics is personnel, right? I think Elizabeth Warren said that politics is personnel. So you also have to put people in place. You know, you look at Mitt Romney's father, you know, who actually was implementing and pushing those policies, even though the Nixon administration didn't want those policies to happen. So economics, though, is key in America because America is expensive. When you talk about having a nice home and having to have $15,000 or $20,000 down, you might as well, in terms of us, say you have to have hit the lottery. We don't have it. So economics has to be key. But the question becomes, how do you keep that money? Because what white supremacist structures love to do is say, we're not going to put you in the flow of wealth and wealth building. We have all of those. We have all of that social capital. Because how the Confederates got back in was through social capital. That's how they got back into the flow of money. We don't have any social capital. So in terms of how we get back into that flow, it's going to have to be the government saying, you have to put these people back into the flow of wealth building. You have to do that. And you have to find a way to give them back what was taken. So if the land is not for sale, find it somewhere else. You have to put them back into land ownership because you took it. We have to have, we can't do it just with income. So even when you talk about factories and that sort of thing, right? We talk about factories, but we don't have any. Why? Not because we haven't built businesses. There was a great story about a man who built, a black person who built a newspaper way back in the day, Adolph's man, who the person who built down the newspaper was, his newspaper plant was a white man who worked for him. You know, you can go back to Black Wall Street. You can go back to all of these times when we have been plundered. And you have to not only put us in a position to own what we own and have what we have and protect us from these sort of white capitalist predators who just say want to give the money back to me. And that's what you want to do. Because we've never had it. We've never been trained in wealth building. So at a certain point, you want to be like, yeah, I like a Ferrari or I like this. There has to be a way to do that, to kind of design it for specific plans that build wealth as opposed to just what everyone would like us to do is to get in the lane of consumerism and just, oh, you got a bunch of money. Let's go buy some stuff. Reparations is a seed that we need to plant to build wealth for future generations, and America needs to keep pouring wealth into the group until that racial wealth gap is zero. We're equal. We're equivalent. And it makes no sense. When you look at the charts, what you'll see is that even people who have come from other countries, whether they be Latinos, whether they be black Africans, no matter who they are, whether they be Europeans, they come here and they catapult. You know why? Because America has a way of making certain people white, and it has nothing to do with melanin. And it leaves us at the bottom. And they tell everybody else that's these Negroes. They just don't know how to work. They don't know. They have a problem with their culture. They're somehow deficient. So there have to be policies in place to protect that wealth protection, to protect that wealth. But there also have to be policies in place that make sure that when we do have the wealth, we're able to access certain business arenas. We're able to access certain and buy certain land. So a landowner can't say, I don't want to sell to you, and it's my land, I won't sell. I don't want to sell to a black person that drives down the quality of the neighborhood. There have to be policies in place that ensure that that cannot happen, and those have to be very, very, very robust policies. There have to be policies in place in terms of how we're schooled. You can't just say, like the Chicago tried to say, well, you're not, the Chicago, Illinois Supreme Court, I think, tried to say, well, you're not entitled to schooling. How? By what right? By what right is that equal protection? So there are a lot of laws that have to kind of go in tandem with reparations. And what I kind of look to Yale and other premier institutions to do is to kind of help us decide what those other things and what those other laws are that should go in tandem to what we're building.
We have a question from Joshua Morgan.
Hi, Yvette. Thanks for being here tonight and for helping us all get an understanding of how to advocate for ourselves and for our allies. My question has to do with how do we advocate for this lineage claim that we're making and this justice claim that we're making, especially on college campuses? And when we're assaulted with things such as, oh, you're xenophobic, or you're not diversifying or inclusive enough because it's such a narrow, specific justice claim that we're advocating.
Thank you, fam. I appreciate that. And I think, you know, when we talk about our agenda, right, we have an, I always say reparations is the heartbeat of a Black agenda. So if you are a Black immigrant in this country, especially if you have kids and if you have a lived experience here, the Black agenda does cover you, right? It is only the reparations agenda that does not cover you, and that's because if you came over here voluntarily to a racist country, it's not the same as coming from the chattel slaves who built the country and lived through Reconstruction and lived through redlining and lived through mass incarceration and have been tethered to the bottom. It is just not the same. So there is a Black agenda that actually covers your lived experience, but lived experience is not lineage. And lived experience is a very different thing in terms of what your contribution to the country was and is. You have gotten, as a person who has come here and made a better life for yourself, you have gotten more from this country than the people who built the country from scratch and have gotten nothing. So I think you have to talk about it in terms of the reason we're carving out this space as ADOS, as a specific lineage, is because we have a specific cause. And we have a specific contribution to this country that no one else has, right? And so that is how you have to kind of speak to that. You have to speak to the specificity. And let's be honest, everybody else always has the specificity. I don't have any problem with a Haitian American or Jamaican American or Nigerian American or Ghanaian American telling me where they come from and what their lineage is. And that's wonderful. I understand who you are, and I respect that. I need everyone else to respect us, too, in terms of what we are in this country and what our contribution has been. You know, when you talk about the Immigration Act of 1965, it came right after the Civil Rights Act. So a lot of people, a lot of Black immigrants and other brown people who are here because of the freedom struggle of ADOS. And so there has to be some respect for what we built that allowed you to come here and make a life for yourself. Right? And there also has to be some support for what has happened to us. And we've already given our part in terms of what we've done. And let me just say this. ADOS shows up for everybody. Whether you're talking about Amadou Diallo, whether you're talking about Botham Jean, whenever a Black immigrant is assaulted, we don't ask, well, are they ADOS or a Black immigrant? We show up and we show out and we stand for you. And I think the call to action right now is for Black immigrants to stand for us. We've always stand for you. We have never had any kind of tribalism. We have never said that you know, Black immigrants can't live in our neighborhood. We have never done some of the stuff we've seen around the world where people throw Molotov cocktails and try to run people out of their communities. We've never done any of that. We have always been here for you. And I would say to Black immigrants, now is the time for you to be here for us.
When I was there, and I won't say it, so we've been together for 5 years.
Thank you for that. I am going to unmute Herbert Campbell to ask a question next, and then we have a bunch of questions being sent to me privately as well as in the chat that we will address. So let's hear from Herbert.
My question is, I know that in terms of justice, reparations is the right thing to do in terms of, you know, just justice and morally, but outside of that, is there an economic benefit to, you know, just to the overall American economy if a reparations claim is met?
Well, there is actually an economist. I can't remember her name, but I think she used to work for I don't know whether it was JP or Citibank. But she said that racism costs in terms of, it cost America like $16 trillion. That's what it cost to the economy. $16 million lost to the economy. So when you look at what she says, it's not just a loss to ADOS, which is my primary concern. It's a loss to the economy for this kind of racism to run rampant in the system. In terms of, think of how many ADOS kids who, because they don't have good schools or because they don't have good wealth, right? because they don't have intergenerational transfers, cannot make it to the helms of these schools to actually contribute to the economy the way that they should be able to contribute to the economy in a meritocratic society. And so there is a loss not only to us, there is a loss to the overall economy because of the racism and especially the anti-ADOSness that this country continues to kind of promote.
So we have a question from the chat. How do you effectively address reparations on a policy level? Do we start on a community level, a state level, or a federal level?
Well, I think, you know, even in terms of what California did, we can start on a community level, but understand one thing, that is not reparations. Because what was done to us was done by the federal government. And I'm not saying state governments weren't involved, but you have to be very careful or it becomes a dodge. So people will say, oh, well, we had reparations plans in a bunch of communities and a bunch of cities and stuff, and so or a bunch of states, and so now we're finished. No, that's not enough. What they can do, though, what localities can do is provide a kind of framework for who is included and what that looks like and how they're trying to implement it. That can be done. But the federal government has to take the lead at some point in doing this because the federal government took the lead in oppressing us. The federal government took the lead in terms of President Andrew Johnson in terms of deciding that we were not, after Lincoln was assassinated, and deciding that we were not going to get our due. Harry Truman took the lead in not doing anything until very late. You know, in terms of lynchings and in terms of airing that racist movie at the White House and furthering white supremacy. So the federal government has taken a lead, even in terms of when you talk about FDR and you talk about his housing and how that segregated us, and even in communities where ADOS and white communities had already integrated, you still put up and erected, even in the New Deal, a lot of stuff that segregated us and relegated us to the ghettos in terms of how that started. So you still have, the federal government has to take a lead. And the local government doing things, I'm not opposed to it, but it cannot be a dodge. And it cannot be a dodge away from ADOS. You cannot say minorities. It cannot be about just people of color. It cannot be about just black people. It has to be about a very specific group of people in terms of being able, at least with one parent, to trace yourself back to slavery and sharecroppers and everything that happened. There was a specific kind of harm done to our community, and there has to be a specific kind of redress. And it's not a minority redress or a people of color redress, it's an ADOS redress.
So we have a question from Antonio Moore. He shared a couple slides.
I just wanted to come in and just make sure that we, I'm one of the co-founders of ADOS along with Yvette. And I think one of the quintessential issues we're having now is people just don't understand the scale of where we're at. This chart was done by Ray Diallo. I added colors, Ray Diallo being the billionaire, one of the richest men in the world. And what he showed is that basically the last time the bottom 90 and the top 0.1 had the same amount of wealth was 1930. Well, the lines were going to cross when he made the chart. They've crossed now. What you see is that a lot of people don't understand the necessity of reparations and think it's just something that you can add on or live without because they don't understand this chart. Now, across the horizontal is time, but I'm going to in a second add numbers so you also can see numbers because it's just as important, meaning how much wealth was in American households in 1930 versus today. And one of the things that you see is that our psyche, and here it says black psyche, but it's white psyche as well, is built off of the time period when this line is going up, this red line. This red line is the share of wealth held by the bottom 90. So in 1980, it peaks out around 35% of all of the wealth in households. It's in the bottom 90. There's a great amount of sharing, New Deal, affirmative action. We then have Reagan with deregulation and everything else, tear it the other way. And by today, what you see is for the first time since the Depression, the bottom 90 and the top 0.1 have the same amount of wealth again. The difference being, and on the second chart you can show, white America now has $100 trillion of wealth. So we talk about Dr. King and we talk about civil rights, and I totally understand, but I don't think we understand the gravity of how the moment has changed over a really a single lifetime. So white America in America at large in 1962 has about $473 billion in household wealth. By the time you get to 80, it's at like $2.4 trillion. By the time you get to 89, it's at $24 trillion. We're now at $100 trillion. So what you see is that whiteness has codified, has calcified their wealth inside of whiteness and now doesn't have to act it out in everyday actions. So now what you find is that while there are, I think, nearly 190 million whites, they live in 83 million homes, almost 15% are worth $1.2 million or more of those 83 million homes. Out of 20 million black families, 43 million blacks or so live in 20 million homes, only 350,000 break $1.2 million. That's it. Only 5% of those homes break $350,000. So we run into this world where I'm just framing what Yvette is saying. If you don't deal with reparations, just be honest that you are relegating ADOS people, and particularly to a calcified consequence of the theft that was done to them. And I ask Yvette, when you look at these numbers, how different is it? How much more necessary is reparations today versus even in 1962?
Well, I think in 1962, you had a good job because like you could build a life with labor. In 1962, you could build a life with labor. And so if reparations didn't happen and it should happen, you could still have a different life. You could buy a house. Like my parents bought a house, right? Because they had labor. And what happened with unions and everything else, what happens is you can't do that anymore. Everybody has allowed the top, and it's not just the top 1%. We should stop saying that. It's the top 1% and everybody that services the top 1%. So you allow all of that money for labor to flow all the way up top. So labor gets nothing. So we're gig riders now. We're riding in Uber. We're riding in Lyft. And we're driving Lyft. Sorry, not riding. We're driving Lyft. And we have no protections. That's no money. You're basically liquidating, like Antonio says, you're liquidating your car, right? And so what happens is you can't build wealth in that environment, and we can't even take care of our families in that environment. There's a vast difference between where we are now than in 1968. So people who talk about it kind of revert back to that and try to live off of speakers and leaders who talked about what needed to happen during that time don't understand what has changed since that time.
We have another question from the chat. Since we have lived a multi-generational apartheid enabled by the American government, how can we make sure that there are people in government who are committed to restoring Black Americans as full citizens? It seems the current political landscape is not passionate nor concerned about the redress needed to make ADOS whole.
You know, in terms of our leadership, I think we have to take some responsibility for that. In the sense that we have never, as a group, you know, we had we talk about the Rainbow Coalition and things like that. We have never, as a group, said, listen, there is a specific cost that's baked in to being ADOS. And, you know, it's baked into being a specific lineage. And we need our leaders to focus on that because we're drowning. We haven't really done that. And we haven't really held them responsible and held them to account to how they need to navigate that specificity, especially for those that are in mostly ADOS districts who then decide that they want to do the bidding of Nancy Pelosi as opposed to the bidding of the people who elected them. To advocate for them within that political sphere. So I always say what's important is how you come into a room, not just whether you come into a room. So how we have come into the room in terms of ADOS, in terms of ADOS politicians, and even in terms of the way they get treated by other white politicians, is that they don't have any wind at their back. They haven't created or attached themselves to any political movement. If anything, they have been sort of oppositional to their own movement, right? So I see ADOS do a lot more sometimes for DACA and speak a lot more. Like at the Supreme Court, ADOS was there during the Byron Allen's lawsuit about the Civil Rights Act. You know, we talked about 1866. We were there because that was something that was about economic inclusion of ADOS and was written specifically of ADOS. We were there. ADOS people were there. The NAACP wasn't there. Black lawmakers were not there. But the NAACP was there for the DACA hearing. So they have not shown up for us in ways that are meaningful. And I think part of that problem, though, is that we haven't shown up for ourselves in ways that are meaningful and said, listen, you're going to do this for us and push for us, or you are going to just be an irrelevant relic of an organization. And that's what we have to do at this point.
Do you have a question from Richard White? I'll go ahead and ask a question from the chat. Can you speak to how black and brown immigrant success is confused with ADOS success and blurs the issues?
One of the things that happens, right? So America understands that ADOS is failing. We're falling off a cliff. The policymakers understand that, not regular people. But policymakers understand that we're falling off a cliff. So the question that they have is like, how do we hide that failure? So you bring in immigrants, especially elite immigrants from West Africa and elsewhere, and they become a disproportionate part of the people who go to Ivy League schools and so on and so forth. So you'll look at Harvard and you'll say, oh my gosh, Harvard has 14% black population. Black people are really, 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 really doing more. And you don't understand that probably half or more of those people are black immigrants. They're not ADOS. They don't come from slavery, right? And then you'll have another small percentage that are biracial, and Lonnie Guinier and Henry Louis Gates talked about this in 2004, who are anchored in one white parent who may have wealth, right, and who anchors them in a different way. So when you talk about the group that is poor and impoverished and whether or not they make it to Ivy League, what happens is that these groups mask our failure and they mask the fact that we don't make it there, right? And so what you have here, because I always say you don't have to be white to be a tool of white supremacy. You have them being model minorities, and they can check African American or Black American, because they're probably more African American than me. We've been, my family and probably most ADOS people, we've been here many generations. We're more American than African. So they're not the same as us, and they're coming from different backgrounds as us, and a lot of them have different wealth levels as us. Go back to the wealth of LA chart where the Nigerian family was doing far, far better than the ADOS family. How do you do that? We've been here 400 years. You got here first generation, second generation, and you are doing better than us. That's because we've been tethered to the bottom. But because you look like us, people can say, oh, I have diverse students, or I have a diverse company. Diverse is not the inclusion of ADOS. Diversity does not make ADOS whole. And so that's kind of what we come back to. We can't just have diversity. We have to have a specific kind of concentration and focus on ADOS as a group, as opposed to just the browning of anything, right? Because even, you know, you see it even with, you see in tech, in Silicon Valley, you have a lot of brown, quote-unquote brown, you have a lot of Indian-American people who are heads of tech. So this isn't about melanin. This is about lineage. And a lot of those people come from Brahmin caste, where they are the top caste in their own society, and they perpetuate that here in America. And so if we don't understand lineage and what lineage means and the cost of lineage to ADOS, we won't understand anything. And too much of the conversation that we have had has been about minority or black and brown. It hasn't been ADOS as a specific group that is owed a specific thing because of a specific oppression by America and a specific contribution that we made in America.
We have a question from Richard White, who is unmuted.
How you doing? It's two questions that come, two thoughts that come to my mind. And one kind of you already spoke to as far as the black political leadership and the type of positions they're supposed to take in relationship to ADOS and reparations, which they're not. The mathematical question I I'm thinking about is, what do you think is the numbers of policy makers that have to be a part of this process to create a robust transformative policy that deals with ADOS? That's one side. And then what do we say to those other interest groups who are truly, who are concerned about the debt clock, which keeps clicking, and the amount that it would take in order to really fulfill the obligation, the debt owed to ADOS, to ADOS community?
Well, what I would say is this, in terms of your second question, a debt is a debt. Like, you don't get to tell your, you don't get to tell your landlord or your whoever owns your mortgage, or you don't get to tell whoever owns your car note, well, you know what? I think that's kind of high. I know I signed up for it. I know I did it, but woo-wee, you talking $500 a month for that car you gave me? Well, I've been looking at it, and I don't think it is what it should be. You don't get to say that. You get to pay the debt. And there are a lot of arrangements. I've said before, I think it should be multi-generational. But, and I think it has to be, not should. It can't be one and done. That's just a recipe for disaster. And it can't be anything less than robust. You have to keep tweaking this thing as you go along, because some stuff will work really good and some stuff won't, and some people will figure out a way to get around certain things, and you have to tweak it. So the Reparations Commission, has to kind of always be going and checking, and it just can't be dissolved after we decide we want to do reparations. But the other thing I will say, in terms of what you said at first, in terms of a specific number of people or lawmakers, I don't think you have to have a specific number of lawmakers first. Like, that's something that has to happen later. The first thing you have to have is a specific understanding. We don't have a specific understanding. It seems like the majority of Americans view us as just black people, and they don't understand that person is American, absolutely, because they were born here, but they may have a lineage that goes to Haiti. That person, they may have just got here, because most Africans came to this country after post-1990. They don't have my history of having a mother who was a sharecropper and a father who had a broken home for reasons not of his own doing. So they don't have that cost. That cost is not baked into blackness. That cost is baked into ADOS. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have a daily kind of, they don't experience racial discrimination, right? But we saw the police put an Indian man almost, I don't know if it was a permanent paralysis, but he was paralyzed, and he wasn't ADOS, he was Indian. So you can be Guatemalan, you can be a lot of different shades and colors and ethnicity in this country and still suffer daily racial discrimination. But we're talking about a different cost that extends all the way back to slavery. And I don't think you can have a specific amount of lawmakers until you have a specific understanding about what this group has endured and what this group has contributed to America.
Thank you. We have some questions. Sorry, Chris. We have some questions that are being asked privately in the chat here. What is the specific ask from academia, Yale and other educational institutions that has or has not been done to push reparations for ADOS, but also along those lines? Someone has noted that in Ivy League spaces in general, and as well as Black spaces, have been hostile to ADOS. So how can we mobilize in these spaces as well as incentivize ADOS administrators to advocate for ADOS in admissions as well as retention programs without being accused of racism and xenophobia against students of Black immigrant descent?
Sorry. I think, once you understand the specific cost, you understand that it's not xenophobic. And once you understand, but I think there has to be, and I would love to, and I think ADOS now is not just a group, it's always been a political movement that's anchored in a specific lineage. And we have a 501c4 now, and we would love to work closely with Yale and any other institutions in kind of determining what that looks like, what that redress looks like in terms of quantifying that, because you all have access to statisticians and different things that I will never have access to. So we would love to crunch that data with you all and figure out what that framework looks like. I think that's the role of like premier institutions like Yale in terms of you could really help us, because we don't really have that. But what I will say also is, we have been advocating for, it's kind of like what Latinos did in terms of they have a different kind of ethnic framework of having Adolf be a specific kind of ethnicity, so that we don't, so that nobody can, so if you just came here yesterday and you are from Ghana, you don't get to just mark black as the same as Adolf who descend from slavery. We're two different groups, right? And so I think it would be helpful if we had the Census of Office of Management and Budget, which kind of sets those ethnicities and races, if we could have them actually say, hey, we're going to disaggregate ADOS from just other black people. Because when you do it, like when you do it, when the color of wealth Miami, the color of wealth Boston, and the color of wealth LA, when you do that, when you disaggregate ADOS from other black groups, you find that we're on the bottom of groups that immigrated here after us. And that tells you something about our specific condition, right? And I think we have to lobby for us to be disaggregated from the data and say, when you apply for an institution, not just being ADOS, I would actually add into that income being a part of that kind of, or your parents' income when you talk about college being a part of that metric or being a part of whatever equation you set up for the affirmative action for ADOS specifically. Because when LBJ announced that at Howard University, he was talking about being hobbled and how you can't just come up to the line and say, you know, now go. It was specifically for ADOS. It wasn't for other people. And so I think we have to own that, and I think we have to, you can't count something that you don't measure, right? If you've ever said, hey, I'm a bit pudgy, I got to lose a little bit of weight, you understand that I gotta weigh myself, and I gotta look at what I eat during the day. You can't really quantify anything that you don't measure, and you can't measure us as long as you lump us in with other groups. So the first thing that we have to do is disaggregate ADOS from other groups, from other black groups and other immigrant groups. There's no such thing as people of color. It's not BIPOC. And that's disrespectful to all other groups, too, because every group has a different, distinct lineage and a distinct contribution that they bring. So it's kind of disrespectful to me. I don't care whether you're Honduran American or whether you're Kenyan American. It's disrespectful to say, to throw everybody in one group. You have to disaggregate the group, and you have to talk about what are the specific costs borne to this group and what is owed to this group. And you have to come up with a metric and a kind of equation for affirmative action, and have that affirmative action be for ADOS in terms of hiring and admission. And do it in a way where you, once you quantify things for people, I think it becomes, and I don't think it even looks discriminatory anymore, because you say, oh my God, ADOS in Boston are worth $8. How you been here 400 years and you worth $8? Well, white supremacy is how you do that. And I think once you see that, and once you see the cost and how that cost is baked in, you begin to understand what we're owed, and it doesn't look or even come off as divisive when you do that. Because it's not.
Oh, that's what they're paying. How old is that? So a question from the chat. Can you speak to the power of media and how we desperately need proper representation in it, and the dangers of celebrity worship and giving media personalities unearned credibility?
Well, when we talk about media, I think everybody needs to look up the Telecom Act and how that decimated, you know, ADOS media, how that decimated what we owned and how we were able to tell our own story. And it gave our story, and that happened under Bill Clinton. So it's not just about Republican, Democrat. This happens under all administrations. And that decimated our community and our ability to talk about our own pain and to talk about our own economic, you know, for lack of a better word, our own economic pain and what we were going through, and to tell our own stories. We don't have that anymore. And so black media matters. Our ability to put on our own shows, put on our own talk shows, and really kind of highlight what we go through and what we live through every day and what our economics look like versus your economics is very important. Because one of the things that happens is, you know, you go out and Asian people look just like white people, look just like, you know, look just like people of color, quote unquote, look just like black immigrants because we wear clothes, we look nice or whatever. And so you don't really get to come into our lives and see what our lives really look like and how much our lives are not like your lives. And even white poverty is different from black poverty. There are a lot of things that show that. So this is not to say that white people aren't poor, but we're saying that we can trace our poverty and our disenfranchisement all the way back to slavery and Reconstruction, and we can trace it back to everything that was promised to us that was not done. And so we have to, and we need to have our own media. Now listen, every administration and the Obama administration had an opportunity to do this. The Trump administration did, and of course they didn't. But you can actually pay media outlets to have ads in terms of army ads and different things like that in order to kind of shore up that we at least have some kind of ad income. That has never happened for us. And so we haven't had the ability to tell our own stories. The only thing we've had is our stories told for us. And the stories that have been told for us on our behalf have not been our true stories. And, you know, kind of what Antonio talks about is the decadent veil. So you have this kind of social engineering. So you see LeBron and he's doing good. You see black actors and they're doing good. Everybody's talking about how good everybody's doing. And it leads white America and other people of color America to believe, oh, look, they're doing it. They're really doing it. Hey, well, look at them. All right, now do it. And you don't understand that the truth is in the wealth data. And the wealth data shows we have nothing. We have nearly no wealth. And they have covered up. The same way they have masked the fact that we don't have any intergenerational wealth transfers, and you need that in America. And the only reason we don't have it is because we're a plundered group. And so you have to have that kind of decadent veil removed. Black celebrities don't speak for me. Now, we can use them where we can in terms of trying to give them our message and saying, you have a microphone, you go say it. And so that's kind of what happened with Ice Cube. You have a microphone, you go say the thing. So, but in terms of just coming on and talking about a black girl magic and all this stuff, that doesn't represent real life in terms of what is happening to Adolf on the ground.
Thank you. We have another question from the chat here. It's about the specific role of reparations in K-12 education, given the historic link between slavery and the educational debt. Basically, what are your thoughts on that? How can it be implemented?
Well, I think the first thing we have to, somebody asked me yesterday, well, what do we need to learn? What do we need to do? And, you know, and they asked me, because I was talking to a group of black immigrants, and they asked me, what do you have to learn? And I say, you know, there are definitely things that you have to learn, but there are definitely things like the educational system. Part of the reason that we have this idea that a debt is not owed is because we have these books in education that teach us that ADOS is, you know, chattel slaves in this country were little happy migrants. And there is a whole disinformation campaign that is put into schools that teaches us that we were just happy migrants and we were not chattel slaves and the horror that goes with chattel slavery. And it doesn't teach about the freedom struggle in this country, right? So even when you have other immigrants come to this country, especially black and brown immigrants, nobody talks about and nobody teaches them when they come here, listen, the thing that made your curve pass straight was the fact that Adolf fought a freedom struggle for a long time, and you owe them to be here. So there's an education gap in a lot of ways on both sides in terms of K-12 and everything else. It's not just, and it includes this, the prison, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline. Even when we talk about that, you see articles written about people of color. When you go look at the school-to-prison pipeline, though, you find that most of those kids are little Adolf kids. It's most of those kids are not people of color kids. Most of those kids are not brown kids. Most of those kids are Adolf kids who are getting sent to jail or prison while in school. And we don't have that conversation, and we don't advocate enough for accurate information, K-12, so that when people come out of that, you know, I've talked a lot to members of the Jewish community who are still, you know, or have recently left Germany. And what they say is that You can't teach this stuff about members of the Jewish community or the Holocaust. You can't teach misinformation. It's illegal. You can't do it. But in this country, we allow that to happen for ADOS. And so people begin to believe, oh, this is who they are. They're lazy. They're culturally deficient. There are all these things that white people have kind of, white supremacists and white racists have kind of come up with and put on the books, right? And what we have to do, we have to take the education system back and say, listen, this is no longer okay. In the same way it's not okay in Germany to put that into a book or to have any kind of Holocaust denial in a book, that has to be the same here. You cannot do that anymore. And we have to be full-throated in terms of ourselves as ADOS, but our allies. If you are allies, you have to protest against the book, or you have to protest against ADOS history not being fully taught or just being taught for a couple of days during Black History Month. We are central to Black history. We are central to history. ADOS history is central to history in this country, and it should be taught in your schools. And if you have a child in the school and they're not being taught what you know, because if you go to Goodreads and you type in Breaking Brown, Goodreads Breaking Brown, there's a whole book list, and a lot of it is ADOS books. You know, if you read that this stuff is inaccurate. And we have to depend on you to say, listen, this is not going to be taught in the schools. Because a lot of you all in this chat, in this room, have a lot more power than I do. I don't have kids. You have kids in the school system, and you have a lot of power to direct and determine what that looks like. And I think this should even be a part of our reparations push in terms of changing the curriculum of schools and mandating at least XYZ hours about this, at least XYZ days, that this has to be a part of the curriculum, because we've been erased in the system, and our contributions have been erased, and that erasure continues when we're not included accurately in the education of the K-12 system.
Would you mind elaborating on the Black agenda and how this is distinct from the core reparations claim?
Well, when you talk about the Black agenda, we talk about everything from disparities in healthcare. Now, all of those things are disparities in the prison population, right? Now, all of those things have affected ADOS, so they're on the Black agenda because of that. But guess what? They impact everybody. When you talk about Blossom Jean, I'm sure the cop who gunned him down in his own apartment, you know, didn't say, that's a Black, or he's descended from immigrants, or whatever the case may be. So you have a lived experience in terms of those things, whether they be interacting with police, whether they be healthcare disparities. There are a lot of things where you have the same kind of experiences, because guess who you look like? Guess who we are? We come the same, and people always say, now I don't see myself the same as a racist police officer. So I can't say, well, we're all the same because a racist police officer sees us the same. No, we're still a distinct group. But because he does, we have a Black agenda, which includes you, because you have health disparities. You have you may come up against housing disparities, right? So those have most affected us. But the Black agenda, I'm not going to carve that out and say, well, you don't get access to that. No, you get access to those things when you talk about all of that. You have to have, and we're creating a space for people who have that lived experience but don't have that lineage. So you have a lived experience where you may have been discriminated against because you're Black. So that agenda is for you. HBCUs, a lot of Black immigrants attend HBCUs. We want to fully fund HBCUs. That is not just for us, but when we talk about reparations as the heartbeat of a Black agenda, that is where we say this is just for us, because it extends all the way back from slavery through Reconstruction and all the way back to here. I can draw a line that binds. If you look at any of the economic data, it shows me that we are still even below Black immigrants in a lot of measures, and that tells that we are the bottom caste in this country, and we have to have repair.
Speaking about repair, will reparations address the psychological damage that may occur in ADOS, the psychological damage from being on the bottom?
Well, I think we have to have, and I think, you know, experts can help us figure out how to do this, because you have to implement something. So it's not just about understanding that something is necessary. It has to be implemented as well. But I've always said that we have to have some kind of lineage therapy, because what I find with you know, most of the people that I interact with are ADOS, and there is trauma, right? There is trauma from your father going to jail and your mother being evicted. You live out of a car. And so there is trauma from we don't have enough. I don't know if I'm having enough to eat today. I had to live in a homeless encampment, and so I kind of still have nightmares about that. There is trauma from that. And so what I would like to do is to kind of create some kind of framework to have in terms of and implemented inside of a reparations bill to have low cost or incentivized therapy of some sort for ADOS who don't have therapy to get it elsewhere. I mean, don't have the resources to get it elsewhere, who don't have insurance and that sort of thing, because that trauma plays out. Even in terms of our workforce, even in terms of jobs, even in terms of how we raise our children, that trauma stays with us. You know, there's a book I think that says like the body keeps score. So even in terms of our ailments, a lot of our ailments are traumas that we haven't unearthed and we haven't dealt with because we don't have somebody to sit down with and sob and tell them everything and them give us new tools, new psychological tools to deal with that trauma and to understand how we can move forward and what wasn't our fault and how to deal with some of the stuff we saw. We got people in the ghetto in Chicago and elsewhere. You might have saw somebody, you might have saw your best friend get shot down in front of you. And you've never had any kind of therapy to deal with that. And you have nightmares about it, and you try to pack it down. But the funny thing about packing down trauma is that it crops back up in the worst of ways. So you may be at a job, and somebody says something to you, and they trigger you, and you start hollering and screaming. And then you get fired, and somebody says, they're erratic. They can't be here. They can't be here because they haven't dealt with their trauma. And there's nobody there to say, hey, hold on. You have trauma from how you grew up. You have PTSD from how you grew up. And so let us help you through that so that you can put yourself in a position to deal with your stressors and to deal with what happens to you very differently. We want to put you in a position where you're psychologically whole. And we have never put in force in this country a plan to kind of help ADOS deal with that in terms of the lineage therapy that is necessary. And when I talk, that's why when I talk about reparations, I talk about a comprehensive plan. This is, wealth has to be redistributed. Yes, that's part of it. That's absolutely part of it, but it's not all of it because we have a lot of trauma that we have to unpack. And because the American government helped inflict that trauma, they have to be a part. It has to be institutionalized in terms of them being part of what helps us unpack that trauma and work through that trauma.
So given the magnitude of intergenerational trauma and harm, it sounds like there's definitely room for more than one federal reparations bill. But could you elaborate on the importance of developing additional proposed reparations legislation outside of H.R. 40?
Well, I think H.R. 40 is kind of slim. You know, the funniest thing is that I had a conversation with the author of Redress, who talked about Japanese reparations to help get the Japanese reparations. We had a very good conversation. And one of the things that you find out is that their reparations bill for the years that the Japanese were interned by America was much longer than ours. So how do you have their bill being longer than ours and we were 400 years still, we're 401 years in this thing now. I think you can have one reparations bill that you make changes to as you go, right? So we just can't have one and done. We have one and start, not one and done. So you have one and you start a process and the changes that need to be made, you do year after year, day after day, as you find like what's working and what's not working. It's just like a company where you find like, hey, this thing doesn't work. I kind of guessed and checked. I guess wrong. That didn't work. So I'm going to do something else. This didn't work. It's being misused or it's been abused or this policy didn't work. So I don't want to say that it can't be. I think you can put together a robust bill that you just kind of provide amendments and changes and you continue to craft it as it goes along in terms of what works and what doesn't work. Because understand, this is the biggest thing that America will ever do. Like reparations for ADOS is the biggest task. Is the most mammoth and monumental task that America will ever undertake. And so you can't do one and done, but you can do something that's extremely comprehensive and make changes to it in different outlays year after year and year after year in terms of how you budget it.
So thank you so much. I think that will be it for our seminar today. Yvette, do you have any final words to share with us?
Well, I just want to thank you. I just want to thank you, Christopher. I just want to thank you because I appreciate you actually, you know, bringing us on and having this conversation. And I just want to let everybody know, you know, we look forward and we're hopeful to being able as an institution, as ADOS, the organization, working with Yale, because I think you all could be instrumental in terms of how we do this and in terms of how we are able to kind of craft this in terms of, you know, there's so many books and there's so much stuff that's been written and you have to kind of quantify that and qualify that and what does that mean and what is that number and what does that look like? Okay, that's a number. So how is it actualized and implemented in terms of ADOS life? And I think you all, in terms of the people who are here from Yale, could be instrumental in that. And I hope that, you know, Yale